want you to imagine, if you will, something in your childhood, probably, where you only did it once, where you either had consequences or ramifications, or you got in trouble or something, and so you made a choice, you did something, and you decided, I'm never doing that again. I was going to offer an open mic at this point, but I don't know if we are all ready for all of your stories. I had an experience, and I didn't even think about my parents being here when I thought of this story. So I don't know if they know this story. They might. It's not real embarrassing, so don't get worried. But what happened when I was in probably second or third, I think third grade-ish, those little snap bracelets, they still have them, but those snap bracelets really became popular where you snap on your wrist and they wrap around your wrist. You hopefully know what I'm talking about. Those became really popular really quick. And so for some reason, I was on the playground with some kid in my class that I really didn't hang out with very much, so I don't know why we were playing together, but we decided, actually he had made this decision and I just joined in, so I'm going to put some blame on him, to chase this particular girl, this particular young, pretty little girl, and we were chasing her around the playground with these snap bracelets, trying to, I don't know for sure exactly what we were trying to do, in third grade, you don't probably think all that clearly sometimes, but my thought was, is I was trying to snap it maybe on her wrist or something, and like, you know, like a game of tag or something. Well, lucky for me, as I was the first one to get her, you know, to hit her with the snap bracelet. The problem is I didn't hit her wrist, I hit her eye. Yeah, and so obviously very quickly the game changed, actually the game ended, and she ran and talked to one of the leaders or teachers outside and said what happened. I got talked to by the teacher. I don't know if I went to the principal's office, but I know I got a talking to by the principal about that inappropriate behavior. Apparently, there was no rule against it, so I don't know why he was so upset. But anyway, I got talked to. I was one of those kids that never went to the principal's office other than for, you know, good reasons, positive reasons. And so that was a little bit disturbing to me. You know, the whole getting talked to and all the whole thing going on and that kind of stuff was disturbing to me. But to top it all off, you know, and I went to a much larger school than a story here, probably 500 or so kids in my school, and that was just kindergarten or preschool through third grade. The whole school now had banned those snap bracelets. And for our class in particular, the I believe it was the Phi Ed teacher, the next day or later that day, stood up in front of the class and said, snap bracelets are no longer allowed at the school, and it's because of one of the students in this class. And a couple kids, obviously the girl I hit with and the other couple kids looked at me, and I would, you know, wanted to die kind of a thing, basically. So I never did that again. In fact, I learned, first of all, that I don't like snap bracelets anymore. Even when my kids bring them home, it's not that bad. But I also learned not to chase girls on playgrounds anymore because that just gets you into trouble. So, I don't know. What do we do in our lives and the way we move forward a lot of times is a lot of times we do that. There's a lot of things we learn as children where we monitor our behavior and then we modify our behavior. Right, we start by learning about this is something that I, you know, did, and this is a consequence, or this is the ramification, and then I change my behavior. And we obviously don't do that in all situations all the time perfectly well, but a lot of the little things in life we do. It's just kind of a natural thing. A lot of times we do. The problem is then sometimes circumstances, situations come up, and something slips out, and you just think to yourself, well, where did that come from? How did that slip out? Where was that mentality? Because again, it's something maybe you didn't even think about, or you don't think about very often. It's kind of something that's changed. But the thing is that we probably know where it comes from in the end, right? And that's what we're talking about this morning as we look at, this is our last sermon in the series called Guardrails. We're looking at one particular area that really kind of encompasses all the areas in a lot of ways. But this is going to be a little bit more pointed towards relational dynamics and that kind of stuff. But putting up guardrails, what we've been talking about is we look at the road, we can see the guardrails that you can kind of see in the background there, the guardrails that we have in our road and our system. They're designed to keep us from rolling into or getting into trouble, right? They're a system designed to keep us safe. But in our lives, we've defined it this way the last couple weeks. It's a personal standard of behavior that becomes a matter of conscience. Personal standard behavior that becomes a matter of conscience. Choices, decisions, things we put in our lives, behaviors that we want in our lives, so that we that our conscience lights up when we get close to that guardrail and we say, okay, too close, gonna back up. In fact, the image we've been using is this image of putting the guardrails in the safety zone. It doesn't go in the danger zone. If it's in the danger zone, you're already in danger and it doesn't do you any good. And so we want these guardrails in a place where, yeah, it's maybe gonna, you know, we could probably go a little farther or further than we did, but we want to keep ourselves safe, so we put these in the safety zone, which I think is going to be really important for us, especially this morning. But financially, morally, relationally, any area of life, we put these behaviors to not to modify necessarily as much as to just light up our conscience. Say, okay, I'm getting emotional, there's a certain emotion I'm having, I know I automatically respond this way when I have this emotion, and so whatever guardrail we need to put in to say, okay, how do I calm myself down, or how do I adjust this, is basically what we're talking about. And so thinking about it as far as the heart, Solomon gives us a great, very direct kind of passage from Proverbs 4. In Proverbs 4:23, he says very pointedly exactly what what we're talking about. He says, keep your heart with all vigilance, for from it flows the springs of life. And the other translations, I think, make it a little clearer. But basically, it says guard your heart. Take care of your heart. Take care of the things inside of you, because what's going to come out, hopefully, like Solomon says, springs of life. Unfortunately, a lot of times, that's not what comes out of our mouths, and mine as well. And so that's what we're looking at, guarding our heart. How do we guard our heart? And what are images or what are maybe even practical things we'll kind of get into as we go through this as well. But we'll be in Matthew 15. If you've got your Bibles, I encourage you to go there. There are some Bibles in the pews. You can use a Bible app if you feel so inclined. But in Matthew 15, we see this interesting interaction between the religious leaders of Jesus' day and Jesus. And this happens, obviously, over and over again in the Gospels, in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. But this particular instance is, to me, rather interesting because of the way Jesus responds and kind of the confusing image for us. And so I don't remember studying this ever before. It's a part of Jesus' message as far as more for his closer disciples, but it's something that I don't know that I've looked at before, so I was really intrigued to learn some more of the cultural dynamics and that kind of stuff that's going on. But just to kind of make sure we're at the same page, I don't know if you've got, my page has a nice little, or my Matthew 15 page here has a nice little map, and I didn't put one on the screen, but if you've got a Bible map quick, they're going to be in Gennesaret, which is this Matthew 14, Jesus walks on the water across the Sea of Galilee to Gennesaret, and Gennesaret is trying to think of a map. So if the map of Israel is, that's not helpful. All right, so it's further north of Jerusalem. It's about 70 miles north of Jerusalem, right off the Sea of Galilee is Gennesaret. And that's significant because, as we read verse 1, there's going to be the religious leaders are actually going to come from Jerusalem. There's 70 miles. Obviously, for us, 70 miles is, you know, an hour 10, depending upon how fast you decide you're going to drive, right? 50 minutes maybe for some of us. But, you know, 70 miles for them was probably a day's journey, basically. And I didn't double-check that, but, you know, more significant having to walk that far. And so this is kind of a purposeful interaction for the religious leaders, too. All right, verse 1 and 2. Matthew writes this. He says, the Pharisees and the scribes, they came to Jesus from Jerusalem and said, why do your disciples break the tradition of the elders? For they do not wash their hands when they eat. All right, so again, the religious leaders have traveled the 70 miles. They've arrived to really just question Jesus, to try to trip him up, to get him to discredit or to maybe even somehow eliminate him from what's going on and what he's been doing. And so these religious leaders show up, and they ask this very pointed question. It seems kind of innocent enough, right? This kind of, you know, maybe they're just curious or, you know, we want to kind of know, but they are very purposeful about what they're asking because they know they could get him into a lot of trouble with the other Jews in that area. But Jesus, wonderfully as he does, is going to respond differently. I probably need to explain what their question is. So with this idea, just to kind of break it down a little bit, with this idea, this tradition of the elders, most we know, right, that the Jews had passed down these traditions. They'd had the law that God gave them, the Ten Commandments, those kind of laws, and then they built kind of these fences around these laws that became traditions that they passed down. And so one of the traditions of the elders was to wash their hands before they eat. And to me, and I haven't looked at very many of these traditions specifically, but my guess is almost all of the traditions that were passed down were really good to start out with, which is what traditions are, which is how, you know, a lot of the rules we make at home and different things, they have a good root system, but how they come to in practice and how they're lived out sometimes gets a little twisted and tainted. And so what to me, the root of this washing their hands before they eat really comes from a commandment that God gave to the priests and the Levites, those that worked within the temple that served God in the temple. And so what they did is they would wash their hands before they'd go into the temple, before they participated in anything religious or ceremonial or cultic for them. And so what the elders did then is they said, okay, it's good for, if it's good for the elders or good for the priests, good for the Levites, then it's good for everybody, right? So everybody should do this. We should all wash our hands. We should all do these ceremonial washings before we do this or that or the other thing. And so it became much more inclusive than the very specific thing God told them to do, which again, I don't think to begin with is bad, right? The goal was, I think, to honor God. The goal was to give, at least I'm giving them the benefit of the doubt. This may not be true at all. I'm just hoping, I guess. You know, the goal is to give honor to God and give him reverence and in different things. And so they implied this to all. The problem is, again, in practice what that looks like. And Jesus isn't going to necessarily go directly at this one, but he's going to go directly at another one of his law, traditions. Verse 3. Jesus says to them, responds to them, he says, "And why do you break the commandment of God for the sake of your tradition? For God commanded, 'Honor your father and your mother,' and whoever reviles father and mother must surely die. And you say that if anyone tells his father or his mother, 'What you would have gained from me is given to God,' he need not honor his father. So for the sake of your tradition, you have made void the word of God." Everybody got that one? Nice and clear there. This is probably why I've never studied it before. It's nice and confusing. But this is why you guys pay me the big bucks, so I can talk about this, right? All right, so this is, to me, such a cool passage. And we could go back to Mark chapter 7, which covers this as well, maybe even a little bit better. But basically what was happening, all right? So obviously, honor your father and mother, one of the big 10. We got it in the 10 commandments, so that's an important commandment. And they would have said that. Even the Pharisees and leaders would have said that. The problem was is that these Pharisees, Jewish leaders, other even just men in the Jewish culture, they would say, "I'm going to devote all of my belongings, everything that I own, everything that I have possession of, I'm going to devote it to God," which sounds okay, right? Not a bad deal to devote things to God. The problem was is if it was devoted to God, then it could only be used by the person that owned it. They could not give it away. They could not sell it to help somebody else. If it was devoted to God, the person that owned it could use it while they were alive, but it couldn't be used for anything else. Okay? So this person, I would take, you know, if we think about all our belongings and we say, "I'm going to devote this all to God," well, then it's only for me and my, you know, my immediate family's use, and no one else can benefit from it. Which I got to think it would be a great way to give gifts. So I got to thinking, you know, I think Roger probably needs a new chainsaw, so I'm going to buy him a new chainsaw, so it's devoted to Roger, but that means I get to use it until I decide to give it to him, I guess. So, right? Does that make sense? Right? I was thinking, who needs a big TV? Because that's what I was thinking, that someone else needs a big 55-inch TV for a while. But does that make sense? So it's basically saying, I'm going to gift these things to God once I die, but I'm going to use them until that point, but no one else can. And so what was happening then is that they were voiding then the devotion to take care of their father and their mother, especially as they age, which was so important in that culture, right? As people aged in that culture, they couldn't work, they couldn't provide for themselves, those kind of things, so they depended on their children and others around them to take care of them, especially their children. But if their children are devoting all their things to God, they can't help their father and mother as they age. So I hope that makes sense. I think that's such a cool example that Jesus has used here. But basically he's saying, you're saying one thing, it's called Corban, devoting your things to God, but you're avoiding being able to use those things for God. And really it's all about my selfish use of those things, just like the chainsaw or the big screen TV, right? I don't care if you guys ever get them. I'm going to keep them until I, whatever. Anyway, so that's what's going on here. And so basically what was happening then is, like Jesus said, they were for the sake of their tradition, they were avoiding the word of God. And to me, again, that's such a cool example that Jesus uses here. So he goes on, as he continues on here, in verses, we're going to skip down to verse 10 and 11 as this interaction continues. He's going to explain this a little bit further for those around him and those that are close to him. And so he kind of says, "Come on here." He calls the people to himself and he says, "Hear and understand. It is not what goes out into the mouth that defiles a person, but what comes out of the mouth that defiles a person." And so it seems like he's switching gears. That's why no one sits in the front row. Switching gears here a little bit, but he's still encompassing the whole thing. And I really appreciate that Bill used the image of the Old Testament and it being a shadow for us for our communion meditation this morning, because that's exactly what Jesus is saying here too, is you know, we have all these practices and these rules and these laws and these traditions then that have been added onto it, but in so many ways those things aren't what's the essence of this, Again, Jesus always went back, well, what's the heart of the matter? What's the heart of this commandment? What's the heart of what's going on, over and over again? And so he specifically kind of switches gears to what goes into the mouth, into the body. And that's a, you know, we know Jews don't eat pork, and, you know, unfortunately for them, they don't eat bacon and all that wonderful thing, those wonderful things. And so, and other things they obviously avoided too. But Jesus is saying it's not about what you consume, because that's what they thought. They thought if I, you know, eat the right way, if I do my ceremonial washing, if I do all of these things, then I'm right with God, right? And it's so important, that word that Jesus uses here is that word defile. That word defile that Jesus used, we think of like tainted or wrong or something like that, but really defiled means it affects the relationship I have with God. If I am being defiled or I am defiled in some way, that relationship between me and God is damaged or broken. And so remember that as we look at the word defiled. It's about me and God, our relationship with God. And so Jesus is explaining this and saying, it's not what goes in the mouth that makes a person defiled, it's what comes out. And he's going to explain it a little bit further because Peter's confused, just like probably some of us this morning. So verse 15, Peter comes to him and he says, explain this further to us, Jesus. Explain the parable to us. And Jesus said to them, are you also still without understanding? Which, if Jesus ever says that to me, I might just, you know, turn around and just go home, I think, because that just broke my heart, I think. But Peter's stronger willed than I am. So Jesus says, are you still without understanding? Do you not see that whatever goes into the mouth passes into the stomach as it expelled? And again, just a beautiful image there from our Bibles that Jesus gives us of how our digestive system works. But that's, again, that's his point. That's a very physical, biological understanding of the things we eat. Whereas the Pharisees, even Peter, the other Jews at that time, understood it much more not spiritually, but religiously, right? What we eat is a religious experience, especially for them. And I'm not saying it's not important what we eat in our culture, but or where we're at as Christians, but this is much more of a biological response, Jesus says. But he continues. He says, what comes out of the mouth, he says, proceeds from the heart. And this defiles a person. For out of the heart comes evil thoughts, murder, adultery, sexual immorality, theft, false witness, slander. These are what defile a person. But to eat unwashed hands does not defile anyone. Right? Jesus is saying what comes out is so much more important. And so we could look at it, and again, I highlighted the word defile because it defiles the relationship between me and God, because that's important for this whole thing. And he's saying when you eat something, it's the biological response. It doesn't go to the heart, right? When we eat things, it doesn't, you know, go into our heart. But he's saying what comes out of us directly comes from the heart. And he's separating out the way they understood their laws and their commandments and their rules and saying it's not what you think. As important as it is to honor and to respect and the commandments that God gave to the Israelites and ultimately to us are important, but the heart is so much more important. The way you react, the way you interact, the things that come out are so much more important. It's so interesting to me anyway, the list that he gives us. He talks about murder, adultery, theft, false witness. And so often when we think of things of the heart, we think of conceptual things, right? Things I might consider around me, or things that might be something more in my mind that come out. And Jesus is talking about very practical things, right? Slander is something very specific, a behavior. Theft, murder, all those things are things that come out. Even evil thoughts, which is a little bit more conceptual and inside of us, are things that ultimately come out, and we can express those in certain ways as well. And so Jesus isn't just talking about what's inside of us and our heart as far as how we feel. He's talking about how does that get expressed in our world around us. And so Jesus is saying, when he talks about this idea of defiled and talking about the relationship between God and us, or us and God, he's really starting to shift the gears for them. Because the Old Testament was interpreted this way anyway. The Jews, the Pharisees, the people in Jesus' day, even in our culture so often, we only worry about, well, how am I doing with God, right? We have a culture filled with people that say, I'm good with God. If I'm good with God, then everything else is good. I have a relationship with God. I'm praying to him. I'm spending time in the Bible. That's all that matters. As long as me and God are good, everything else is good. And the problem with that is not the way Jesus understood the Old Testament. That isn't the way Jesus interpreted our Bible. That isn't what Jesus came to do, ultimately. Partially, but not ultimately. What Jesus is saying, he's saying it's not just what you happens and in between you and God, it matters what happens that comes out of your heart. It matters so much how you interact with the world around you. Are you slandering people? Are you killing people, and not necessarily physically, but maybe in our minds, or metaphorically, or are we doing these different things to the people that we can see and hear and talk to and touch and those kind of things? Or are we just worried about how our relationship with God is? Because the Pharisees only cared about their relationship with God. That's all they were thinking about. That's all they were worried about. And the fact is, and the truth is what Jesus is saying, how your relationship with God is, yeah, that's only part of the picture. You cannot keep that in a box over here, because the way you interact with the rest of your world, the way you interact with the people around you, yeah, that includes how you relate to God as well. In fact, they're so intertwined that when Jesus gave that command to love God and love others, he didn't stop, he didn't pause, he didn't slow down. He said, it's love God, love others. They're the same. They are tied together. And so when we look at this in terms of guardrails, when we look in terms of our heart and where we're at and the importance of all these kinds of things, right, we can put up guardrails that'll help us stop behavior, which is important, right? It protects us, keeps us out of the danger zone. We've talked about that financially. Well, we said give, save, and then live, right? We set up these practical things that we can do as behavior. What I want to talk about and kind of finish up this morning with are things that we do relationally, but also within ourselves that are guardrails. And so we kind of have talked about most of these over the last several weeks, but there are four areas of life that I want to conclude our time with, four things in our world that kind of come up, and then what guardrail can we have in our heart to kind of reverse the effects and get us back on the right track. And so the first one is guilt. The idea of guilt, this idea of I owe you. I've done something, I've hurt you, something in the relationship has been damaged, or I hurt, something about our relationship is messed up because I did something. So I feel guilt. I feel bad. And so I feel like I need to, maybe I feel like I need to do something, or I just feel like I need to avoid the relationship, or whatever it ends up looking like. So the first one's guilt, I owe you. Anger is the second one, is where you owe me. And I've struggled with this really my whole life, other than the last few years. And the reason I don't struggle with it is what we're going to talk about in just a second. But anger is you owe me. You've done something, I was offended, I was frustrated, and so you owe me something. Retribution, for apology, whatever it ends up being, you owe me. The third one is greed, is where I owe me. And we talked about this a couple weeks ago. Greed is basically the assumption that it's all for my consumption. I worked hard for it. I got this taken care of. I, got an education, and so it's my money because it's what I did. And so I owe me to spend this, to get this, to have this, right? I owe me is greed. And the last one is jealousy, and this one I struggle with all the time too, is life or God owes me. And as a pastor, and I know we all probably struggle with this, I can look at other churches in our community, I can look at churches around the world, especially around the U.S., and I can say, oh, I wish I had that, or I wish I had that, or he's really good at this, and I wish I could do this, and all those kinds of things I struggle with, and we all struggle with. And so we get to thinking, well, life owes me, right, or God owes me, right? And so we struggle with jealousy and what other people have or what they can do and all these kinds of things. And so how do we combat this? What kind of things can we put in our life to kind of put us back on the right track when we're guilty or angry or greedy or jealous? And we do this as examples, as practical kind of things to do. If we're guilty and we feel like I owe you, we can confess. And we can confess to God, absolutely. I think that's important. But you know what? God already knows you did it. It's a crazy thing. He's not ever surprised. He doesn't say, well, I didn't know that. Who's not keeping me? Anyway, so we confess. But confess to God, absolutely. But confessing to someone else is probably more important. And probably if you feel guilty towards somebody in particular, that would be a great person to confess to. To say, this is what I did. I feel bad. I wish I didn't do it or said this or whatever. And we confess to them. We say, maybe apologize, or we find a way to resolve that situation. That is how we protect and guard our heart. We confess our guilt. Maybe it's to someone else. Maybe if we feel guilty about something that we can't fix or we can't talk to a particular person, we share it with somebody else, a spouse, someone we care about, a friend, that kind of thing. Anger, again, for me, I struggled so much in my life with anger, and it's because I couldn't forgive. I felt like someone owed me something, that I got a fair deal or something like unfair deal, and so I couldn't forgive. And so that, to me, is a huge step for me in the last several years, is I was able to forgive. I maybe I had to share that feeling or my anger with somebody that I was angry with, and I do that from time to time. It's not ever easy, and it doesn't seem like it gets any easier ever, but I found that so much of my anger needed to be, I just forgive you. I forgive what you did. They may not ever be sorry, but I'm going to forgive it, and I'm going to move on. And so anger is a huge, as far as forgiveness, is a huge part of alleviating anger. As far as greed, like I said, we talked about a few weeks ago, where I owe me, like we talked about, just give. I say just, and giving is, can be so hard. In that sermon, obviously, we switched the paradigm of how we usually spend our money, where we live first, save second, and then give last. We switched that, right? If we give first, right away we get our paycheck, we get a gift of some kind, and we just give it away. It's a huge way for us to alleviate that greed, to alleviate the assumption that I can use it, it's my for my consumption. And if we give first, save second, and then live on what we have left, it changes the whole dynamic. And the last one is jealousy, where I feel like life owes me or God owes me, we can just celebrate. Which to me is such a huge thing. It's small, but it's also really huge, where we start to celebrate. And first of all, I think celebrating for ourselves is a part of that, where we're thankful and we're grateful for what we have and what we've been given. Instead of looking at everybody else, we can say, you know, I've got it pretty good. And as a pastor, looking at other pastors in around the world, I got to say, I got it pretty good in a lot of ways. And so I'm thankful for that. But at the same time, we can celebrate other people's victories, right? I can be excited for another pastor that has something go well for them. I can be excited for other people that get something that I would love to have had, but I'm so glad that you were able to get it and able to celebrate with you. And so looking at those, it seems like, oh, that's just so simple. My life is fixed. Everything's taken care of, right? I solved all of our problems in a few minutes here this morning. But that is so hard to do. So hard to live that out in a practical way. But I promise you, and I haven't done, obviously I'm not perfect with these things by any means, but I found the more and more I do these hard things on the right side here, the so much less that I feel the things on the left side. And to me, even just practically speaking, God gave us these things and these images and these things to protect our hearts. Because the way we interact, the way we commune, it directly affects the way that we relate to God. And so that's my hope and that's my prayer for us as we move forward. Again, Proverbs 4:23, Solomon wrote to us, keep your heart with all vigilance, for from it flows the spring of life. And that's what I want for myself, and that's what I want for all of us. But in so many ways, it takes these kind of things to live out a life so that we can be those springs of life for those around us. Let's pray. Gracious Father, again, just thank you so much that Jesus came to give us that example, to give us this image of life for us, and that when we look and we are purposeful about these things and we live them out in this world, we live them out in our relationships, that our relationship with you just automatically gets better. That we are drawn to you when we confess. We are drawn to you when we give. We are drawn to you when we forgive. We are drawn to you when we celebrate other people's victories. And Lord, we just pray that that happens more and more. That it's not about rules and keeping all these things and doing all these things and washing our hands and you know, sacrifices and all these things that we maybe think are, well, if I do those, then my relationship with you is good. It's about the stuff that we do on a relational level. It's the stuff we do in our heart level. And I just pray that we all in this room, in this community, can be a part of that and be able to be those springs of life for those around us. I want to pray this all in your Son Jesus' name.